This is Talk of the Nation Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. Imagine living in a city like New York or Chicago, teeming with people, but no running water, no toilets, nothing that resembles modern sanitation. That was London in the 1800s. And as you can imagine, London was also teeming with human waste, being no toilets or sanitation. And while it seems obvious to us now, city life without sanitation is not a healthy place to be. But back in the 1800s, people knew little about how disease was spread or the role of bacteria in human waste in making people sick. Illness was a mystery. It was chalked up to evil spirits or a bad air. But that changed with the 1854 London cholera epidemic, when an astute doctor and a local priest were able, with a terrific piece of detective work, they were able to figure out what was making people sick. My next guest has written about that epidemic, the investigation that followed, and how it changed the future of city life. Stephen Johnson is the author of The Ghost Map, the story of London's most terrifying epidemic and how it changed science, cities, and the modern world. His previous books include Mind Wide Open and Everything Bad Is Good for You. Welcome back to Science Friday.
Thank you, Abby. It's great to be here.
Let's talk about the name of the book, the title. Where does the ghost map come from?
The ghost map refers to this semi-famous document that one of the two heroes of the book, Jon Snow, who was a local doctor and a tremendous kind of 19th century intellect, just interested in a million different fields. And he ended up, in doing this investigation, this kind of detective work and tracking down this terrible outbreak, he had basically pinpointed that a pump had gotten contaminated at the center of this neighborhood in Soho.
And describe the situation that was going
yeah,
on.
Yeah, sure. Well, London, as you alluded to, was a city of 2.5 million people. Nobody had ever built. It was the biggest city in the world, but it was also the biggest city in the history of the world. Nobody had ever tried to cram that many people into one city before. And it was just a mess. I mean, it was just, there was no functioning sewer system. People had cesspools in the basements. And there was an enormous amount of livestock in the city. It was just a repulsive place to be in many ways. And because of these conditions, cholera would just sweep through and kill 10,000 people over the course of a summer every 4 or 5 years, starting in 1832. And there was a real question. I think this is one of the things that's important to kind of reconstruct. There was a real question about whether cities of this size were actually going to work out, whether they were going to be a sustainable proposition. Nobody had ever tried to do it before. And a lot of reasonable people at the time looked at these terrible outbreaks and looked at these conditions and said, people weren't meant to live like this. And London was going to be like ancient Rome, and it was going to collapse down to 10% of its size. So
did they know that the cholera was coming from something, or was it the vapors, like I said, or something in the air?
The dominant theory at the time was this miasma theory, that there was something in the air, something in the smell. Mm-hmm. I mean, the pioneering public health reformer Edwin Chadwick once testified before Parliament saying that all smell was disease. You know, that was the kind of theory. And if you'd smelled London at the time, you probably would have agreed. But there were a few folks, really Jon Snow most prominent among them, who had developed this counter theory that cholera particularly was a problem of water supply and not a problem of, you know, poisonous air.
This is before the germ theory.
Yeah, they really didn't. Yeah, they had no disease. I mean, Snow was never able over the course of his lifetime to actually see the bacterium that causes cholera. But by looking at patterns, both in who was getting sick and who wasn't getting sick, and also I think it's important that Snow was trained as a physician. And so he recognized in the symptoms of the disease that it seemed like something that was ingested rather than something that was inhaled. And that led him in this direction as well. So he had developed this theory really in the late 1840s, actually, that cholera was in the water. And he'd published it in a bunch of different places and tried to get people to come around. And basically it was, you know, either in some cases ridiculed, mostly just kind of ignored. And so he was kind of, in a sense, waiting for – In a kind of grim way, waiting for an outbreak that would help him prove his case. And he was living near, just on the outskirts of Soho in London in 1854, working as a doctor there. And a pump got contaminated right at the center of the neighborhood of kind of Golden Square, which is in the western edge of Soho and the most densely settled part of London at that particular time. And it was a very popular public watering hole. Basically, it was reputed to be the best water in all of Soho, and so people would come from quite a ways away to drink from the water. And it got contaminated with cholera, and within about 3 days, this terrible outbreak just tore through the neighborhood. And on Broad Street itself, where the pump was, the neighborhood was literally decimated. 10% of the population died in about 6 days. So it was an enormously concentrated explosive outbreak. And Snow went straight into the belly of the beast.
Of course, he didn't know that it was the pump.
But he thought...
He did this math.
His initial instinct was that an outbreak this explosive suggested what they would call now a point source outbreak, right, where there's a single kind of source of the epidemic. And so he thought probably, given his theory, that he could find some kind of water supply that was contaminated. So he went in, started knocking on doors, interviewing people, you know, as people are being literally carried down the street by the cartload.
And throw out your dead.
It's just the old Monty Python.
Right.
And, you know, this enormous act of courage on some level to go into the middle of this neighborhood that everybody's fleeing from in terror. And he very quickly hits upon the idea that this pump at Broad Street was probably the culprit. And over the course of this investigation, he enlists the services of this other interesting figure who's been largely ignored when people have told this story before, but turns out to be just crucial to it, which is this guy, Henry Whitehead, who was a local minister who was not a man of science, although he was open to scientific explanations. Mm-hmm. But what he brought to the case was a great kind of social intelligence. I mean, he knew everybody in the neighborhood. He was one of these local, you know, priests who was coming over for tea and actually hanging out in the tavern late at night, tossing back beers. He was that kind of man of the cloth. And he knew everyone. And so he got kind of roped into this investigation, and he was able to track down in the weeks and months that followed all the people who had left and was able to figure out who had consumed water from the pump, who hadn't, where various families had gotten their water, and so on. And he ultimately actually tracked down the index case, the patient zero of the outbreak, which turned out to be a little girl who lived across the street from the pump.
When you say patient zero, that means what?
That means the first case that kind of started the epidemic. Mm-hmm. And so Whitehead and Snow ended up collecting all this data. But the problem with data is sometimes it just – you look at a statistical table and you say, well, I see a lot of numbers here, but I'm not necessarily convinced of this. And so one of the ideas that Snow had was that if you made a map of the outbreak, that it might be, you know, more persuasive kind of visually. And so he created this map where he basically took all the dead, and for each address where somebody had died, he created a little black bar. And if there were 10 deaths there, you had 10 black bars. And when you did this and looked at the kind of bird's eye view of the outbreak, you could see the death kind of radiating out from this central point where the pump was at 40 Broad Street. And so the map became, in a sense, a kind of a marketing vehicle for his theory. It was a way of making it immediately clear to somebody who didn't want to look through all the numbers that there was something fundamentally wrong with the water in this pump. And over time, it ended up working.
Talking with Stephen Johnson, author of The Ghost Map, the story of London's most terrifying epidemic and how it changed science, cities, and the modern world. And this was a breakthrough, right? This was breakthrough forensic, like a CIS case we would see on TV today, right?
Exactly. Somebody said that to me the other day. It said it's like ye old Victorian CSI. and you know, that's one of the things that was so fun about writing the book, is that it does have this kind of detective story going through it. But it's such an interesting point in time. And there had been a number of other major cholera outbreaks. And so the thing that I was interested intellectually about this story as well is, why did this one end up being the one that ultimately kind of turned the tide towards a waterborne theory?
Yeah, that's a good question.
And a lot of it was that Snow brought a lot to it. And Snow was what we might call now a consilient thinker, in that he was capable of basically analyzing the data on multiple different scales. So he was thinking – he couldn't see these invisible bacteria, but he thought they were there, and he was analyzing the water to try and see that. But he was also thinking about the body, the individual patient's body, and the symptoms of the disease. But he was also thinking about the neighborhood almost as a sociologist or epidemiologist. And the map was a kind of a bird's eye view of the neighborhood. And so the theory only worked when you had somebody who could work on all those different levels.
Right.
But it also needed this other form of expertise. It needed Henry Whitehead. Snow was not actually a great kind of social character. He was not particularly good with people. but Whitehead was. And so when you put those two things together, you get, one, this kind of amazing, unlikely kind of friendship that develops in the most terrifying situation you can possibly imagine. But at the same time, you get this kind of complementary form of knowledge, of different disciplines kind of coming together and looking at a problem from all those angles simultaneously. And I think that made a big difference. The other thing was that, paradoxically, the density of the neighborhood was both crucial to how severe the disease was. There were so many people crowded together using the same pump. Uh-huh. But it also made the solution possible in some sense, because you could see the patterns more clearly because there were so many people kind of in the database to kind of look at. And so the density of the city both was the source of the problem and ultimately kind of the source of the solution.
Did he have a lot of trouble convincing people?
Yeah, it's you know, you kind of want these stories to have the kind of eureka moment when, you know, he
right.
brings out the map and everybody goes, "You're right." You know,
of course, we could have said that a long time ago.
But it doesn't happen like that, and it took the authorities started to come around. He did manage to persuade one kind of local committee of the waterborne theory, but the official public health report that was issued about the outbreak rejected the waterborne theory entirely and didn't think that it was persuasive at all. But over time, the world started to kind of come around to Snow's idea, and this is where it's an interesting case study in how good ideas in science kind of win out over less good ideas, and each time the story kind of would come up as the thing that people would point to, and there was something about kind of the icon of the map and the kind of nature of the story uh-huh. that people would say, well, we're coming around to this waterborne theory. You remember that Broad Street thing, and Jon Snow had that map, and you know, and so over time it started to become more and more kind of convincing. Snow died in 1858, so he saw the progress, but he never really saw it fully endorsed.
Right.
But Whitehead lived to you know, several decades later, and in fact, there was another outbreak in 1866, and it was right in the middle of the time where they had started building the massive London sewers project, which was very much a response to this increasing awareness that they needed to clean up the water.
All right, Steve, hang on because we have to take a break. We'll pick up this very interesting story, the ghost map, story of London's most terrifying epidemic and how it changed science, cities, and the modern world. Stephen Johnson is my guest. We'll go to the phones, take your questions. Stay with us. We'll be right back. I'm Ira Flatto. This is Talk of the Nation Science Friday from NPR News. You're listening to Talk of the Nation Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatto. We're talking this hour about the London cholera epidemic. Stephen Johnson, author of The Ghost Map, the story of London's most terrifying epidemic and how it changed science, cities, and the modern world. Our number 1-800-989-8255. Let's see if we can get a phone call or two. Let's go to Neil in San Francisco. Hi, Neil.
Yeah, I just want to mention that San Francisco had a big cholera epidemic in 1849 and 50, right at the time of the gold rush. You know, all of a sudden, from a very small outpost of a few hundred people, it acquired up to 50,000 people almost overnight, and many prominent people died in this epidemic. It was going around a good many places in the world at that time, and so I just thought it was an interesting, an interesting sidelight to the subject you're talking about.
Thanks for calling, Neil.
Yeah.
You know, it's interesting. Thank you for that call. It's true. I mean, if you think about this whole experience from the point of view of the bacterium itself, these cities without, you know, kind of functioning sanitation systems with masses of people crowded together was the greatest thing that ever happened to the cholera bacterium, because it was a fantastic reproductive environment for them.
Right.
What they want to do is get into other people's small intestines, basically.
Right.
And when you
right.
combine the kind of drinking water and waste systems, you get that. And it shows you, I think, one of the lessons I think that's beautiful in the midst of all this carnage about this book is it shows you the connectedness of these hugely different scales. I mean, the city is, in a sense, the largest kind of footprint of life on the planet. It, you know, you can uh-huh. see it from space. And at the other end of the spectrum, you have, you know, these almost invisible forms of, you know, viruses and bacteria that below which you stop having life, basically. And so at that point in London's history, the single most kind of powerful force reigning in its growth without anybody attacking them from overseas and with this tremendous economic engine they had at the time, the bacteria was probably the single most powerful force kind of keeping them from getting even bigger. Mm. So you have the two ends of the spectrum locked in this kind of evolutionary dance over time. It's an extraordinary thing.
So how soon was it before people said, we need to have some sanitary facilities here?
They started really at the end of the 1850s. There's this famous thing called the Great Stink of London when it got incredibly hot in the river. Just people were passing out, and they said, okay, we've got to deal with this. And the waterborne theory had started to take off, and so they started building the sewers. And then this outbreak came in 1866, and it was because basically they had not set up the water filtering systems correctly. But they treated it as a water problem, and they posted notes saying you have to boil your water if you're in this infected area.
So they know there's something in the water.
Well, by that point they had started to think it out. And by the early 1870s, the sewer system was basically built. And the 1866 cholera outbreak is the last time the cholera attacked London. So, in just 12 short years, they effectively solved this problem that had just been devastating the city, based initially on the kinds of insights that Snow and Whitehead had figured out on the streets of London in 1854.
Did it spur anybody, knowing that this had been in London and had been traced to the pump handle, to this pump, and say, hey, I'm going to go look for these microbes?
People were trying to see them, and in fact, Snow had brought samples from the well to show folks who had microscopes, but they were unable to see it. It turns out, for a long time, we thought that Koch had discovered the actual bacterium in the 1880s, but it turns out a guy in Italy in 1854, actually, ironically, had spotted the Vibrio cholera. But we didn't know this until like 50 years later. But it was named after him, actually, in the 1960s, actually.
So he finally got credit.
Yeah, exactly.
Science marches on. Let's march to Dale in Eugene, Oregon. Hi, Dale.
Hi there.
Hi.
My question related to a book I was reading not too long ago called Planet of Slums by Mike Davis. And I was wondering if your guest had some insights from his research into the megacities in today's third world countries, where you have just teeming masses of people several times the size of London back in 1850, and with sanitation that's probably on a par with what they had then.
It's a great question. In fact, the last kind of closing chapter of the book talks explicitly about that, because it is so relevant. It's relevant on two ways. I mean, I think the in a sense the hopeful part of this story is that what happened once they effectively solved the problem of cholera in London and in other developed cities, it set the stage for the great kind of demographic transformation of the planet, which is the mass migration to the cities. We started as a species in 1800 with 3% of us living in cities, and right now, about 2006, we're just crossing over to 50% of human beings live in metropolitan areas. And that was unthinkable when you looked at London in 1854. That would have been the worst news possible. We now accept the idea that large metropolitan-scale cities can function and can be actually engines of health. People now, when they move to the city, have longer life expectancies because of hospitals and all the resources. But as the caller points out, in many ways, what's going on in the megacities of the developing world is exactly what the Victorians were wrestling with, only they're dealing with 25 million people instead of 2.5 million people.
Yeah, there's a story in the New York Times today quoting the UN. I'll read you the paragraph. 150 years later, after you're talking about London, it says, the toilet and the latrine, which helped revolutionize public health in New York, London, and Paris more than a century ago, are among the most underused tools to combat poverty and disease in the developing world. There are still billions of people around the world who do not have access to basic sanitary.
Exactly. The lack of clean drinking water may be the single most important kind of health issue facing the world. And the difference between then and now, of course, is that we know how to solve the problem. I mean, cholera, for instance, is that both a disease you can prevent by creating this kind of public health and sewage infrastructure, but you can also treat it just by rehydrating people relatively easily. So the Victorians were trying to invent all this stuff. We don't have to do that anymore. We just need to get the resources to the people who need it.
Ruth in Little Rock, hi. Welcome to Science Friday.
Hi. I've got a couple quick questions.
Sure.
I teach epidemiology, or I have taught it for a while, and we always talk about the Broad Street pump and John Snow, and it's always exciting because the students get to see the map. But there seems to be a lot of mythology around this. One is that he discovered that that's where the microbes were coming from, so he took the handle off the pump and the epidemic ended. And then later people said, well, that's really not true, that the epidemic curve was on its way down anyway. It was just serendipitous. And then the second question is that apparently in one of the areas that he was mapping, there was a brewery, so the people that lived and worked around there did not get cholera because they got free beer from working in the brewery. So I'm wondering if any of those myths are true, or if you've heard those, or if you could comment.
Yeah, they're all of those in different ways are in the book. You're right in that there is this kind of shorthand version of the story where he persuades the authorities to remove the handle of the pump, which in fact he did, although the authorities weren't necessarily convinced of his argument, but they had nothing better to do. I mean, they were like, we're helpless here. We'll listen to this guy. But it does look like the epidemic was in fact on the wane before the pump handle was removed. However, one of the things I talk about in the book that I kind of reconstructed in looking at the timing of this is that the father of the baby girl who had actually started the epidemic came down sick after the pump handle had been removed. And if, in fact, it hadn't been removed, he might have actually recontaminated the well all over again as he was sick. So it's possible, in fact, that the handle did stop, a kind of, in a sense, a second wave of the epidemic.
And the brewery?
And the brewery, yeah, there is a brewery there, and they were given supplies basically of malt on the job, and they did have much smaller infection rate.
They were drinking the beer instead of the water.
Yeah, I mean
drink beer instead of water.
It's an age old strategy. I mean, there are these antibacterial properties of alcohol that for millennia have kept people from getting waterborne illnesses when the water supply wasn't reliable.
So was the beer killing the bacteria that they were drinking in the water, or were they drinking the beer and not the water?
They were probably drinking the beer in this case, right?
Thank you.
Well, I hope we solved that for you, Ruth. Now you can go back and teach it and read the book. Thanks for calling.
Okay, bye.
1-800-989-8255. Future books, any other kinds of science mysteries? Are you now on a science mystery?
Well, I have to say that this is the first of my books that I've written, science books before, but this is the first one that's had a sustained narrative through it. And I just loved writing it. I mean, it seems kind of silly to write five books and finally hit on the idea that, stories are fun, but I think I'm going to do more of it.
Did you ever hear of Ruchet?
Yeah. He wrote all those
for the New Yorker, he was the what do you call it? In the city of New York, he was the public health director, and he wrote for the New Yorker many years ago in the 30s, I think, or 40s. And then he put it together in a book, Typhoid Mary, things like that. So they're very fascinating.
I think, being able to – my project for this book as a writer was to try and tell it in a sense with four main protagonists, both Snow and Whitehead, but also the bacterium and the city, and to figure out how you could tell a story that kind of bounced between those three different levels.
Sounds great. It's a great book. I highly recommend it. It's called The Ghost Map, The Story of London's Most Terrifying Epidemic, How It Changed Science, Cities, and the Modern World. Stephen Johnson, thanks for being with us today.
My pleasure.
Good luck to you.
Thanks.